Welcome back to the Wealth Actually podcast, the show that features artists, entrepreneurs, experts, and commentators that will give you the right knowledge, planning, and guidance so you can preserve your assets and enjoy your wealth. Learn more and subscribe today at wealthactually.com. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes. It is neither investment, legal, nor tax advice and does not represent the opinions of the employers of the host or guest. And now, here's your host, Fraser Rice.
Welcome back to the Wealth Actually podcast. I'm Fraser Rice. Cryopreservation was once the purview of science fiction and Hollywood. Freezing oneself to be revived in the future used to be something out of an Isaac Asimov book or a Ridley Scott movie. However, the science and economics on this call option on immortality are here right now. It's a legitimate and current estate planning issue, and a fascinating one at that. Science, ethics, governance, economics, and good old-fashioned drafting are in focus as I speak with Scottsdale-based attorney Mark House. We're going to get our arms around the misconceptions of the freezing process and what that means legally and practically. With that background, we'll dive into the structuring and drafting considerations to effectuate this amazing concept. Finally, we have some fun by guessing at what the world may look like with revived citizens hundreds of years from now. Welcome aboard, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Fraser. Great to be here.
Well, we are going to be talking a little bit of estate planning, a little bit of current events, and a little bit of science fiction here as it relates to suspended animation and things that you might see in either a horror movie or Star Trek or something like that. But it's something that I think is becoming a bigger and bigger issue, and it's the intersection of cryonics and estate planning. For those of us who only loosely understand what that is, maybe talk a little bit about the concept of cryonics and how you got into estate planning and how you got into that intersection.
Sure. We'll take that chronologically because that's probably the easiest way to deal with it. I got into estate planning. I went to Emory University School of Law and had Jeff Pinnell's Trust and Estate class and just fell in love with the material. And I had the luxury of finding a position coming out of law school where I got to do estate planning as part of my practice. So I worked in Birmingham, Alabama. Interesting place given the recent Alabama Supreme Court decision. But I practiced it in doing estate and gift tax work in Alabama for a couple of years before I moved back out to Arizona, where I'm from. And I just really liked the estate planning process and being part of estate planning as a practice area. With the tax changes in 2001, I ended up doing more trust and estate litigation work than straight estate planning, but I've always kind of kept my hands in both arenas. Fast forwarding a little bit to about 2013, 2014, I was involved in an estate where the decedent was cryopreserved. And so I was representing the trustee, if memory serves, of that. And they'd asked me to go over to Alcor, which is about 2 miles from my office, to go just see what was going on with the cryopreservation process. So I got to talking to Linda Chamberlain and Max Moore and a couple of the other folks over at Alcor, and they started asking me kind of in-depth questions about estate planning and trust planning for cryopreservation. And I've been a professor since 2009, and I've been studying trust and estates my entire career. So I started rattling off some answers to various questions that they had, and they were like, oh, okay, well, hey, can you help us design some of these things? And they had a very good base model. I don't want to take credit for work that I didn't do. And they've always had a very good base model as a preservation trust, as they call it. But they wanted to do some additional work to it, and they were having problems finding corporate trustees and some other issues going on with that. And so there's no real magic in how I got involved other than it's interesting. I was in the right place at the right time when questions were being asked professionally of kind of how some of this process would work. And then once you dive into that rabbit hole, it's just a blast as an academic to go in and look at everything that needs to be considered when you're putting together a trust that may or may not last for hundreds of years. And particularly when you may not have a current distributee of those assets where your beneficiary is a, what is in effect, revived human being that's going to be coming into existence 200 or 300 years from now.
In the industry, but as a fan of it, and as someone who you start, as you say, go down the rabbit hole and you start thinking generations and generations and hundreds of years in the future as to what that's going to look like. And then combine that with what does a revived person look like? And then the dork in me is sort of like, well, if they quote unquote died before and they revived, is that technically still a person? And all sorts of things we're going to get into in a little bit. But I love it. This is a lot of fun for me to sort of nerd out on this type of stuff.
Likewise. Let me go back a little bit back to 2015-ish, 2016. And I was asked to put together a continuing education, a CLE, for estate planning for cryonics. And I got to just dig into all this stuff. And what is a revived person? Are they the same person? Are they a different person? How is this going to work? All of those types of questions. And so as I got to play around with the material more and more, it's just fascinating. And like you said, we'll get into it a little bit in the next 20 minutes. So I'll let you ask the questions and I'll answer them accordingly.
Well, we'll try to get our arms around it because it can veer off into all sorts of cool tangents. But let's start with the first component. And when we first spoke, there's a real definite distinction between cryonics and cryogenics. And to me, the concept of cooling somebody down and slowing them down and them not completely dying, but a heartbeat every 2 hours or something like that, and preserving them for an amount of time versus someone who actually dies. And then you have some sort of formaldehyde / freezing agent that keeps the material alive for a much longer period of time. Really kind of defining what you're dealing with here. A, what is the state of the art on that front? And then B, how do you help people kind of decide which end of the candle to burn first here?
Let me address a couple of things quickly. My world in cryopreservation, these people are legally dead. And I will speak a little bit to the science, but I'm also going to immediately refer your listeners to go look at Greg Fahey's work. And that's F-A-H-Y. Greg Fahey is one of the leading cryobiologists who works with cryonicists and cryonics, as well as the more traditional cryobiology work. But we are in the world of post-death cryonics. Well, I guess that by definition is post-death cryogenics, or the cryobiology, which is dealing with different aspects of extreme low temperature science. But what happens generically is when somebody's at an end of life and they're a member of Alcor or one of the other cryonics organizations, Cryonics Institute, the other big one in the United States. But for Alcor members, there will be a team dispatched to wherever they're at. So if they're at a hospital here in Scottsdale, the team will go out. And what they do is basically substitute the hospital's life support system for the Alcor life support system once the hospital has declared, or the doctors have declared, the patient dead. So a patient is declared dead, they're left on the hospital life support system until Alcor can get there. They hook up the cooling system and you start pumping the body full of cryoprotectant and cooling it off. You put it in an ice bath and the cooling process starts immediately, so you prevent as much cell death as possible. Body is then transported over to the Alcor facility here in Scottsdale, and they fill the body with cryoprotectant, or the head, depending on whether you're doing a full body or just a neuro. And then you complete the cryopreservation process. So you put the cryoprotectant in, which you mentioned formaldehyde. It's actually a substance called M22, which think of it as a biological antifreeze. And so it doesn't do any damage to the cell structure itself and allows for the extreme cold to prevent any crystallization of the cells due to water being in the cells. So you remove all the water from the cells, remove all the blood from the cells, fill it with cryoprotectant. That allows the brain or the body to be subjected to extreme cold without the formation of ice crystals, because ice crystals destroy cells, right? The earlier you get that process started, so the sooner you get the cryopreservation agent into the body at the hospital, moving it over to Alcor, and the quicker that happens, the better the cryopreservation is going to be and the less damage to the brain that occurs. If that is done correctly, there's very little damage to the brain. It is really amazing how well the brain can be preserved.
And that to me is, again, we get to the science fiction aspect of this, where I didn't really know much about this before it sort of came up on my radar screen a couple months ago. And it truly is amazing where that preservation is right now. So let's get into the estate planning / trust aspect of this. Normally to me, when someone dies officially, that is a triggering event in a variety of different documents and structures and things like that. But it sounds like in the planning that you're doing that something different happens here. Help us go through a little bit about how you set up the structure so that it is able to be maintained through sort of a typical human being triggering event so that it's able to be the concept of reviving can happen sometime in the future?
Sure. So you have a fairly sophisticated audience, so I'll speak more at a high level than I normally otherwise would. But we have two models. Okay, we have what we consider an asset accumulation trust, and then we have what amounts to a dynasty trust. And the dynasty trust is super easy to deal with. If I've got a client who wants to create a dynasty trust for the benefit of their family, it operates exactly like any other dynasty trust would. You just have a weird beneficiary at the end. So you have this trust that's held for multiple generations. And if the person is ever revived, they just become the sole beneficiary at that point in time. But if not, then it just lasts the rule against perpetuities period and continues to operate as any other dynasty trust would. You just have this weird beneficiary at the end. If they're revived, they get everything. So that's actually super simple. That's not the common model. The common model that we do is an accumulation trust. And so, and these are the more interesting ones anyway. So individual dies, their estate is administered. And if the revival trust, this accumulation trust, may or may not be the sole devisee of their will or the residuary beneficiary of the revocable trust or whatever, but you have this trust and all it does is accumulate the assets for the rule against perpetuities period. And when you look at the rules on trust administration, trusts have to have an ascertainable beneficiary. But by definition, an ascertainable beneficiary is one that will be ascertained during the rule against perpetuities period. So as long as you have this ascertainable beneficiary, the ability to ascertain the beneficiary during the rule against perpetuities period, it is treated as if it has an ascertainable beneficiary. And so it has a beneficiary under the restatement and under the Uniform Trust Code. And we just wait the 500 years to see if it's going to actually work. And if it fails at the end of 500 years, ideally we will find another way to solve the problem. But we're hoping that if revival is possible, it will be determined before then. So all that happens is you put the assets into a trust. Those assets grow subject to income tax. I mean, we're not trying to do anything cute. It's just you pay income tax on an annual basis. You pay your trustees' fees. But other than that, those assets just grow. When the person is revived, it's distributed out to them. And we've done different things where it's treated as what amounts to a spendthrift clause for a different beneficiary versus returning the assets to the grantor and treating them as the same person. There's a couple of different models on that are floating around as well.
Interesting. You've sort of answered one of the questions that I would have had, which is, it's one thing to sort of, let's call it, endow the actual freezing and the costs of doing that. But then when someone is revived afterward 500 years from now, it's probably not advisable for them not to have assets to be able to live off of once they're revived also. Do you contemplate that also in terms of endowing the lifestyle around the revived person in addition to the actual paying for the science part of it?
That's the purpose of a revival trust. You actually can't use a revival trust to pay for the cost of cryopreservation.
Ah, okay.
That has to be done separately.
And is that accomplished essentially by having, I guess, a life insurance policy or something that the company is a beneficiary of and that covers things?
There's a couple of different ways to do it. One is the life insurance policy that is paid directly to Alcor. That's the way most people do it. The Alcor Board of Directors allows for what's called a funding trust. So you put X number of dollars, basically two times the cost of cryopreservation, into a trust. And then the trustee of that trust is directed to make a payment to Alcor at your death. And it's treated as either an admin expense or a funeral expense under Arizona law so that it has priority over creditors. So the idea would be they've cryopreserved you because that happens before the payment is actually made out of any trust, because that happens within hours of death. And so to make sure they get paid, it's treated as a funeral expense or an expense of administration. So yeah, they have the funding trust model that allows for the payment of the $240,000 for your full body or $80,000 for your head to be done immediately after death. There's been some problems with getting estates to pay people if it's treated as a creditor's claim.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And it seems to me you would have two different trusts for that. You'd have the accumulating so that the person's ultimately endowed, and then you have, in a sense, kind of a purpose trust on the other side here to pay for the freezing expense, et cetera.
And the purpose trust is basically over within weeks of death.
So you're front loading the payment, and then it's up to Alcor or whomever it is to your net present value of whatever that fee is to keep the freezing going for a period of time.
Yes. So part of the $240,000, Alcor just raised its fees, and I don't know what the new number is that goes in the patient care trust. But when Alcor charged $200,000 for cryopreservation of a whole body, $135,000 of that went into the patient care trust. And the patient care trust is a separate trust that is maintained by a separate board of trustees at Alcor that is there to guarantee patient care. And so that body of money is there to ensure that patients will always be maintained in cryopreservation.
Which leads me down another part of the rabbit hole, which is, let's say the board of directors or Alcor or any other institution changes hands, something goes wrong, the electromagnetic pulse causes things to cause issues with the company, and they're no longer there. How do trustees deal with that in terms of if they have to shift vendors, let's call it? Is there flexibility built into these structures to be able to do that?
Yes, absolutely. So what we did is built inside of the trust in both the accumulation and the dynasty style trust, there's a provision that allows for distributions if the trust protector determines that the settlor's biostasis or cryopreservation is at risk, they can distribute the trustee to distribute money to prevent the thawing, so to speak, of somebody who's been cryopreserved. So that would include being able to move them to a different facility to make completely different arrangements altogether. There's no magic to this. You could get a license and do it at home, I suppose. So yeah, that's built into the document to prevent exactly that problem. But keep in mind that everybody has this misconception that there's electricity involved and power outage could be detrimental. The bodies are kept in what's called a dewar at Alcor, and it's a giant steel tank. And there's no electricity involved. All it is a giant steel tank filled with liquid nitrogen, and then it's got basically a styrofoam top on top of it that floats, because if not, you would create massive pressure and it would eventually explode. So the liquid nitrogen bubbles off at a very slow rate, and every couple of weeks, they just go in and top it off. And so there's not a risk of a power failure or anything like that. In fact, one of the reasons why Alcor is in Arizona is because we don't really have natural disasters here. Our natural disaster is drought, as opposed to tornadoes or hurricanes or earthquakes or anything like that. And so the facility itself is very, very stable and at very low risk of any major natural disasters. It's one of the reasons why they actually built it in Scottsdale.
So you mentioned before the concept of a trust protector, and we were chatting before about sort of difficulty finding corporate trustees or frankly, any trustee who's expert enough at, let's say, the estate planning side of it, the science side of it, and maybe the economics side of it, and making sure this is available now, medium term, and then into the future when it's time to reengage and resuscitate. And so the concept of a directed trust makes a lot of sense to me, where you're bifurcating these different functions and putting the right people in the right spots on that front. Is that sort of cryonic estate planning 101 to have that in place, or do you do different things?
No, it's turned into cryonic estate planning 101. When I first got into the industry, that really wasn't the case. And the first conference that I went to, interestingly enough, Bralcor, or asset planning, as they call it, that was one of the major points, was they couldn't find a corporate trustee that would do this. And kind of looked and was like, surely some corporate trustee somewhere is going to be interested in doing this. It's the most low maintenance trust ever. You don't have a beneficiary currently. All you have to do is accumulate assets. So we reached out to a number of trustees and everybody told us, no, we don't want to be involved. We think this is sketchy. We think this is fraud. And I was like, really? Okay, guys, it's perfectly legal. There's nothing illegal about what we're doing. So I was always a little baffled by the fact that nobody wanted to do it. So we finally actually got to Raymond James Trust, who we went all the way up the food chain to the director of trust operations and sat down with her and we're like, here's what we are doing. So we gave them the document. They came back and said, we don't want to be responsible for making sure someone's cryopreserved. We don't want to make sure their cryopreservation is being maintained. And we don't want to make a decision about when they're revived. But if you can fix all those issues, and this kind of comes back to your direct and trust issue, if you can fix those issues, then we'll serve as the trustee, because why not? And so we built those powers into the trust protector side of the world. And so now we have a three-panel trust protector who makes the decisions about revival, whether funds need to be expended to maintain cryopreservation, whether someone's been adequately cryopreserved. All those issues are made by the trust protector, and they just give a direction to the trustee. So it actually works out reasonably well.
And then I come from a world where the investment management gets sent off to somebody else, the distribution decisions vis-a-vis the trust and maybe other distributees, they can make that decision. And then that corporate trustee administers and files the tax returns and all of that. When drafting trusts like this, how do you think about it in terms of additional distributees and whether or not they have any access to these funds? Do you exclude that going forward, or does that create issues anywhere?
So on the accumulation trust, we pretty much exclude anybody else from being a potential distributee, because we don't want anybody to come in and challenge the administration of the trust.
That to me is so logical, but I'm never quite sure. Depending on the state, you never know.
Yeah. We usually end up naming Alcor as the remainder beneficiary if the cryopreservation fails. If somebody's not cryopreserved, it goes back to almost like the revocable trust or to the will and is disposed of accordingly. But if they're cryopreserved and it's later determined they're never going to be revived, the remainder beneficiary is usually Alcor or some other affiliated cryonics organization. The idea being they're not going to want to fight to terminate the trust the way that a family member would. And so that's how we avoid that problem to the best of our ability anyway.
And that kind of gets away from issues like prudent investment and diversification and things like that. On the investment side of things, it's, again, one beneficiary, or it's lined up to be that way. And again, it has a purpose to it in many ways. So you sort of get away from that pretty quickly.
We have an investment policy statement that we hand to clients when they come in, because a lot of clients ask, how will this be invested? And we give them the IPS and say, this is the model that we're going for with Raymond James, because you're looking at a 200-year time horizon.
Right.
And you also don't want to have a massive amount of income every year. So we do take a more long-term approach to the investment strategy. Again, I've got an advisor from Raymond James that I work with on all of those issues as well. You also, interestingly enough, we make it so that the trust protector can approve the accounting. So you don't have a weird statute of limitations problem with a beneficiary coming back and saying, 180 years ago, you screwed up this investment. So try to solve some of those random problems as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, on that accounting front, and you've already in some ways solved the problem. I mean, is it good practice for one of the other trustees slash trust protector to go through that accounting exercise, I don't know, every 20 years or something like that, just to say we're on schedule, we're thinking about it, as opposed to discovering 50 years from now that an issue developed and something wasn't elected correctly or something like that happened?
We actually have the trust protectors meet annually, and we're still building out that model long-term. Alcor has a committee that is designed to appoint successor trust protectors because, again, trust protectors are individuals. And so you need the ability for these people to replace themselves, or if not, that we have to have some mechanism for doing so. They get statements annually and are, in theory, supposed to review them and bless anything that goes wrong. And we're actually building out long-term models, so that's more formal.
Right. Question on situs of trusts. What happens? Do you have mechanisms in place where if the situs of a certain state, whether it's Arizona, South Dakota would probably be top of mind with me just because of the dynasty trust provisions or one of the other favored jurisdictions. But I mean, we're talking about 50 to 100 year to potentially multi-hundred year situations here where there might not even be a United States, or the English language may not even be prevalent anymore, that type of thing. How do you game that out in the future? Do you have things like escape clauses or just total flexibility at the trust protector level to move things around if events warrant?
It's total flexibility at the trust protector side. I played around with a variety of different models on how to do this. And at the end of the day, it's exactly what you're talking about. I can't predict all of the weird potential challenges that could come up in 100 years or 150 years. So giving the people that are there at the moment the flexibility to deal with those as they come up was just the solution that we ultimately fell into, because we can't draft enough without just giving somebody flexibility to go back and say, okay, you can change this. And the trustee didn't want that ability. So the trust protector is the one that has to have it, because they're the only ones that can do it.
Let's talk about staffing the roles for just a second. So if you find a corporate trustee who's willing to serve in that administrative role and essentially be the mailbox for the trust and the I-dotter and T-crosser on the administrative components of the mechanics here, that trust protector role, and you said you had sort of a three-pronged approach to it, or three people that might be a part of that, or three panels. What does that comprise of? I would think that you'd want, let's call it a science person who could be relevant on that front, and then maybe a legal person, and then maybe someone who either has some sort of connection to the family or otherwise. That's a blunt attempt at it, but how do you think about it so that the structure has the right expertise, but also the right qualitative advice around it to have it persist over generations?
So ultimately what we did, or what we're building out, is the initial trust protectors. Two of the three of them are appointed by the grantor. And then the third is appointed by the Alcor Trust Protector Committee. When the two appointed by the grantor resign or die, then the Alcor Trust Protector Committee appoints the replacements. And the rules inside that we're building inside of Alcor are that the Trust Protector Committee, they have to be members of the cryonics community. So they have to actually be either Alcor members, or they're going to be cryopreserved somewhere. And they can't be members of the board of directors, nor can they be members of staff. So they have to be quasi-independent from Alcor. And then, yeah, the goal would be we put people on who have some kind of experience, or at least the ability to go to get the experience that they need. But we're still building that out. I mean, these just haven't been around long enough to go through that second generation of trust protectors and exactly how that process is going to work. We've thought it out. We haven't seen it implemented yet.
So I am sadly going to get us winding down, only because if I keep going, I could have you on for an hour and a half and drive you crazy with my questions. But I have two sort of inside baseball dorky questions here. From a family office perspective, where the concept of a private trust company is in place. So let's say you're having trouble finding corporate trustees, but you have a family office that theoretically has enough in assets to be family endowed for multiple generations, and you want all of that different control over this process. Has that come across your radar screen yet, or is that something you're thinking about?
It did, actually. We had one of those come in, and I was like, you don't need me.
Right.
I'm happy to walk you through the issues in terms of how this is going to work. But if you've got family office style money, you don't need to do any of the stuff I'm doing, unless the person is really concerned that that money is going to get blown going forward. It's going to be reduced to a point where they won't have any left. You just don't need to do the type of planning that we're doing. Because, I mean, even if you just did a straight dynasty style trust, the money at the end would still be sufficient to cover whatever expenses you had. So you wouldn't need to do an accumulation trust. You could just do a standard dynasty style trust, and however you want to do that. One person that I'm thinking about that was a family office style plan, yeah, I quickly realized that I'm redundant in this process. You don't need me.
So Mark, let's talk about the status of a revived person. How does that work exactly?
Well, as you might expect, Fraser, it is completely unclear. So we take the position at the moment that a revived person would come back as a different person. Because if they didn't, you would have some really interesting problems with like Social Security, life insurance. I mean, if you were revived, do you commit life insurance fraud? Obviously, there would be criminal code implications. So I couldn't go kill somebody, kill myself, be revived, and then come back and be like, oh yeah, I don't have to stand trial for murder because I'm a new person. But as I was walking down this particular rabbit hole, I realized that if you apply like the missing persons analysis, which is the closest thing you can get to under modern law, it just falls apart really, really quickly, because you would be able to come back, get your assets back. There's a lot of other mechanisms for people who are lost who were then found. But if you're frozen for 100 years, coming back as a new person means you have a new birthday, a new social security number, you wouldn't come back and be able to walk down to DMV and get your driver's license. You'd have to do some other things along the way. And so we just thought, well, that's the royal we thought that it probably makes more sense to come back as a new person as opposed to the same person legally. And I will tell you, when I raised this in the cryonics community, I was met with a lot of, no, you come back as the same person. And I'm like, philosophically, yes. Philosophically, that's the entire goal. But I'm not talking philosophically, I'm talking legally. Legally, you probably want to be a new person. And I offered, and this offer still stands, although nobody will take me up on it, because your status as the same person versus a new person, if you come back as a new person and that's going to be a multi-generational transfer, you would have to allocate GST exemption to your trust, your accumulation trust, right? And so the decision about whether to allocate GST exemption is a non-hypothetical construct and therefore should be able to be subject to a private letter ruling, although I've not confirmed that overall. But yeah, nobody's willing to let me go explore that to see how the IRS would determine whether somebody's a new person or the revived grantor.
We'll let the new funding for the IRS trickle down before we get them working on that, right?
Yeah, it'll be an interesting problem once we get to it to solve.
So now I'm really going down the rabbit hole here. What happens in many ways if you have sort of this fork in the road when people get revived and they either turn into, let's call it, the members of the zombie apocalypse, or there's been some evolution and what we think of as a human being is different, and then what you come back as is a previously thought of human being? Not that you can draft around that necessarily, but is that something that, if you're not what you were before, and it's either inferior or otherwise, how does that work in your mind?
So this is, again, one of those ideas that we played with and played with and played with when we were drafting. And I kicked it around with a lot of the Alcor staff, including Linda Chamberlain, who was the founder of Alcor. And what would be or what wouldn't be considered to be a revived individual. And as we started playing with it, we're like, okay, if you come back as your virtual self but don't have a physical body, is that you? And if you come back as a cyborg, is that you? And ultimately, we reach the same kind of solution that we reach on so many other issues when it comes to these cryonics trusts, is you got to put it in the hands of the trust protector and hope they'll do what's supposed to be done, because we just can't predict. I mean, think about it. Go back 10 years and just look at the brain-computer interface modeling that was being done 10 years ago versus what is being done now. Being able to predict even that brief period of time, I don't know that most people would have predicted how far we've come in terms of computer-brain interface. And the idea of uploading consciousness and all of these things, some of the other things that Neuralink is working on. And we just don't know where things are going to go. And we certainly don't know how this is going to turn out long term.
Right. That's why flexibility, power, and responsibility in that trust protector role, and hopefully you've staffed it with some people, or at least a process to get the right people in it to be able to do it. You don't end up creating a super race of villains like in Marvel Comics or something like that. And
here's hoping I also don't cause the zombie apocalypse, right?
Yeah, we don't want that either. How big is this right now?
I mean, it's a big part of my practice, but I'm also the only person in the world that does it. So a fairly significant chunk of what I do, estate planning, I probably talk to at least a client a week about this stuff, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it adds up pretty quickly.
Oh, it sure does. And just one other thing. I mean, we mentioned $200,000 for sort of a full body situation and some fraction of that for neurological only. Now, that's a lot of money, but at the same time, it's not that much money for the super wealthy. And for the potential, let's call it call option on immortality, I guess, I would think this would be something that, as people discover it more and more, is going to get more and more popular. Does that track with your thinking, or am I optimistic?
No, I would say that tracks exactly not only with my thinking, but with my experiences. Even in the short time that I've been involved in this, you figure I've been involved for about a decade. As I was joking with the Alcor board one day, I was like, it's gone from crackpot to eccentric. And as things go from eccentric to being more normalized, you'll start seeing the average random wealthy person's like, why not? A lot of the Alcor members and a lot of my clients, they're not ridiculously wealthy. I mean, people who are in the 500,000 to a million range are doing this fairly routinely as well. Yes, I do have the clients who are worth $20, $30, $40 million. And then, of course, family office guy who was worth, I don't know, $800 or $900 million. But we still are seeing people who really believe in the cryonics process and don't have a huge amount of money. And so we've built some models around that too.
And if the price of doing this goes down, which theoretically it could, just includes more and more people into that discussion as well. So that part's fascinating to me. What is the best way to get started if someone's interested in this process?
If you're interested in the cryonics process generally, the first place I would go is just look up Alcor Life Extension Foundation. They have a huge body of work. And then if you're interested in the trust process, you can always reach out to me. My email is mark@beckerandhouse.com. And actually, if you go to our webpage, which is just beckerandhouse.com, that's BECKERANDHOUSE.com. There's a section on our webpage about estate planning for cryonics. Or you can just reach out to me. I'm always happy to sit and talk about cryopreservation, 480-240-4020. So yeah, if anybody wants to reach out and talk to me about it, I'm happy to talk to anybody about this stuff. I love it.
Mark, this was so cool. Thank you for being on. All of that information is going to be in the show notes for the listeners. What an education. And some people are like, oh, trust and estates can be dry and blah, blah, blah. No way. Not with stuff like this. It turns into science fiction and Steven Spielberg movies very quickly, and it allows the imagination to roam free. Thank you so much for being on.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Wealth Actually, hosted by Fraser Rice, author of the book Wealth Actually and a leading private wealth manager. Head on over to wealthactually.com where you can subscribe to this podcast, get your own copy of the Wealth Actually book, and connect with Fraser directly. We'll see you next time on Wealth Actually. Fraser Rice is an employee of Next Capital Management, LLC. This podcast is not investment, legal, or tax advice, nor does it reflect the opinions of Next Capital Management. Any opinions represented in the show are Fraser's individually and not an endorsement of the guests.